This is Wade Rathke. That means it's Friday morning. It's Wade's World, 9 to 9:30 a.m. Central Standard Time. We're on KABF, www.kabf.org. If you want to live stream 88.3 FM on your radio dial. And we'll have a podcast Monday or Tuesday of next week. We're 100,000 watts of people power broadcasting directly from Little Rock, Arkansas. And you know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today, in Managua, Nicaragua, we're talking to Father Robert Curry, a member of the Jesuits, and here since what, 1987?
1987.
So long enough to know better. We're going to find out what Rob has learned here in Nicaragua and elsewhere where he's organized all around the world. Welcome to Wade's World, Rob.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you all.
Look, there are not many people who work in rural areas as priest organizers, organizer priest, or anything else. And that is, I always say we don't do it because we're not good enough to do it, because we never could collect on a membership dues model. We couldn't collect enough dues to survive. But you've been doing exactly that kind of organizing. I found out today, not only here, but in Bihar, India, and the U.S., and West Virginia, Kentucky, where I started school myself back in the U.S., what's it been like to work in this community, and tell us about the community and the Solidarity Group?
Okay. Well, organizing in rural areas has been, I guess, my life since about 1966, which is too many years. But without getting into the past, where I am right now is a small village, 700 people in Arenal, which is a little bit south of Managua here in Nicaragua. Arenal is a village as well as a community. It's a village of 700 people and a community of five villages that has a population of 7,000 people. And when I first went down there, it was during the revolution, which was a great time for Nicaraguans. And I worked for about 7 or 8 years in an agricultural co-op, and growing corn and beans and rice and all.
So when you say worked in an agricultural co-op, you were actually farming. You weren't your fellow farmers.
I became a good old farmer. And of course, I learned a lot. I learned a lot every day, and I'm still learning even now. But it was just a great time to get to know the revolution, number one, get to know some great women and men in Arenal who did everything to work to put food on the table, and to just be witnesses to what it is to live a struggling life, to try to build something new.
How did a rank-and-file farmer out there in Arenal, how did they take the changes of the revolution, because revolutions mean change and hopes and expectations. Were they skeptical? Were they embracing it? There was, you know, obviously lots of problems in those times.
Well, you know, and this is true, I think, around the world. It's true in Arkansas or Kentucky or India or Nicaragua. At the root of everything is the land. Those who control the land have a way of controlling people's lives. And before the revolution, most of the land in Nicaragua was controlled by this dictator, Somoza. And the revolution took all that land away from Somoza, and a good bit of the land was made available to the women and men who had been working almost as slaves of Somoza for 40-some years.
So there was a real redistribution program of people that had confiscated land through the National Guard and some of the sort of Somoza in crowd.
For the most part, the distribution was to groups and cooperatives, to individuals.
Which is better, absolutely.
It was to encourage a collective form of production, and also to make the cooperative the economic base of the local community, so that there would be a sense that this land is made available to folks not for themselves only and their families, but for the wider community. And that's why it was an exciting time. It was an exciting time.
Because they must have been organizing these cooperatives from the ground, literally from the ground
that's
up at that time as well. There wasn't a big history of cooperatives here in Nicaragua.
All the families that I was working with at that time, from 88 to 96, they had all been working basically as slaves of Somoza, earning just about nothing. And the landlords, the Gutierrez, the Sanchez, the Hernandez, and all who owned the land at that time, treated them really terrible, you know. And most of the production was for export. So they weren't producing basic food grains for the community. They were producing tobacco, they were producing sugar cane, and other products to be
just cash crops.
Cash crops for export. So you ask, how did people respond to the revolution? The revolution was seen as the greatest thing that had happened in their lives, because at last they had land that they could call their own. They could plant what they wanted to plant for themselves, their family, and the wider community. So it was, like I say, they were exciting times, because we thought that really we were building something new.
Many cases it was new. Now, these cooperatives have survived?
Well, they survived during the revolution. Since the revolution, their credit was cut off by the new governments, neoliberal governments. They made it almost impossible for cooperatives to get bank credit. And as you know, from your experience in rural areas, a farmer, a small producer, without credit is like a machine trying to work without oil. So a lot of the cooperatives failed. The cooperative in Arenal still exists. It's struggling, but it still exists and has maintained itself.
Now, is there not a credit facility even now for cooperatives to get seeds and get...
With the current government, there is a banking program where they can get loans. But unfortunately, in spite of a lot of rhetoric, the terms of the loans
are steep.
Are steep. Very
how terrible
steep.
That is. Yeah. Because obviously, a cooperative is not based on a profit incentive as much as it is on the collective good of the land and the people living on there.
Exactly.
And I guess the kind of crops that are now raised on the cooperative that you've been working
beans and corn for the most part, but there's also plantain, the green banana, a little bit of coffee for local consumption, some citric trees, oranges, lemons.
But once again, for the local market.
For the local market. It's not to
the town of 7,000 from the 700, not to the...
Right now, at this moment that we're having this conversation, Wade, is a moment of recovering some hope, because since November, we hadn't had any rain. Up until about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
I can say from this week, you've had rain this week here.
That's right. You know. But we lost our first crop this year.
Oh, wow.
We didn't have a first crop. And since if it had not rained by the middle of September, we were going to lose the second crop. But with the good rain we've had the last couple of weeks, we're going to have a second crop. So you know what that means in a rural community. You know, if you have some sacks of beans in the kitchen, you know, ready for the next couple of months, everything's
you're in better
okay.
shape.
But when there aren't any beans stacked, then there's a lot of desperation.
Well, and since we sort of parachuted in this week, we thought maybe it rained every day here. You know.
No, we hadn't had.
Well, that's very interesting.
Not just here. It was the entire western coast of the continent, from California all the way down to Chile.
Yeah, you know, I knew the California drought has been severe and continues to be severe.
But wow. All through Central America.
Well, you know, and I should have known that, Rob, because they talk about the Niños not coming in terms of the weather change, but you forget how connected we are.
Right.
But more than a farmer, you've been an organizer. And
yeah.
It sounds like over the last number of years, the co-op first sort of sent you out to organize more out of that community. And a lot of work with younger groups of people who are doing some fairly interesting things. The Solidarity Group, I think you called them in an earlier conversation. Tell me about that.
Well, when I got to Arenal, like I say, I spent the first 7 or 8 years working in the co-op. But after that time, a lot of folks in the community asked if I'd be willing to go beyond the co-op and work in the wider community, because they were concerned that, you know, the ideals and the hopes and the dreams of the revolution were being lost,
mm-hmm.
you know, because we're in the middle of this 16, 17 years of neoliberal governments. So from 96 on, I started moving around the wider community, and slowly, you know, groups of young folks started organizing themselves, groups of women, teachers, health workers. And over a period of years, they started calling themselves the Solidarity Group. But really, the groups gained their own autonomy just by their own ways of working and organizing. So that now, especially young people, it's young people and women for the most part, they've opened up a popular pharmacy that makes generic medicines available to the community. They have a popular laboratory that tries to anticipate and prevent more serious diseases by getting exams early. There's a small loans program for groups of women, so that not only do they have a little bit more economic independence from the men in the family, which is a problem, but over a period of years, the hope is it will have core groups of women organized throughout the community. And one of the results of all the work of these women and youngsters in the community over the last now almost 18 years is that what in the mid-90s was a community with, for the most part, adult male leadership, now is a community with almost 99% young female leadership. And as we were mentioning a little bit earlier, that has obviously caused a lot of conflict.
Well, and we've met with a group in a low to moderate income barrio, sort of on the outskirts of Managua yesterday, Casa de Mer, where, and the director was telling us that one of the changes in these last 30-odd years is that there's many more women who are represented. They'll have positions, they'll be in government, they'll be here and there. But the voice has still not changed. In her words, they're not heard still. So they have representation without power, in my words.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was a fair statement or not, but what do you find in there now?
Well, I think at the national level, the male power, male dominance is still very much in
machismo.
Effect. In spite of a lot of propaganda about rights of women and all the rest. That's on the one side. On the other side, the strongest organizations at the national level are groups of women.
Excellent.
And this comes from the revolution. And these groups of women, they're really trying to maintain alive the revolution. Whereas in many cases, they've had to come into conflict with male powers who speak of the revolution,
But don't,
really,
don't live it, as we
don't
say.
Don't live it.
Right.
Don't live it. They're,
and these women's groups, from what I heard you describing, are not just, you know, looking at issues like wages and jobs, but are really looking a lot at the cultural issues, as you may call them, domestic,
that's right,
domestic issues, sexual abuse.
That's right.
This is all big news in the United States now, in a funny way, because of the National Football League, of all places to get our schooling on how not to deal with women. You wouldn't think, but any way we can come to more consciousness. But that's been a big issue here. And law number 779, I heard you describe in an interesting way. Why don't you tell us about that law and what's happened to it?
Okay, one of the, maybe one of the greatest accomplishments of the women's groups that have their root in the revolution over the last 4 or 5 years has been the passing of this law against violence towards women. It's probably the best law of its kind in all of Latin America, if not in the whole continent, the whole American continent. Because what it does is it makes abuse and violence against women a specific crime. It's not just a private matter now that can be dealt with within the family and the church and all the rest. It's basically saying that a man who is in a sentimental or a married relationship with a woman and does her harm or even kills her is liable before the law as a specific criminal for killing a woman. And this has, it goes beyond that in the sense of also when there is a divorce, for example, the man has an obligation according to this law to take care of the children of the couple and provide sufficient food for and also for education and all the rest, basically solidifying the rights of a woman on a par with the rights of a man, which in a macho style culture is a great advance. Unfortunately, as we have recently discussed, the president recently without going through the National Assembly or anything of that nature, just on his own, published a list of regulations of this law, which basically eliminates from the law all the, its best points and turns the abuse and violence and even the murder of a woman back into a private affair and takes it out of the criminal order, and which does a great deal in doing away with the rights of the woman, young and old.
And this sort of unilateral action of creating these regulations has gutted the law, essentially, from what
exactly.
I've heard you explain. One of the interesting features we were talking about is one of the changes was the way you got a jury trial as opposed to a trial directly before a judge. And, you know, in the U.S., in a knee-jerk way, we're so trained to believe a jury trial always better. You know, a judge trial always worse. But here, in some ways, it was actually the opposite. Tell us, share with our listeners how that works out in this very terrible situation.
Right. Well, we're dealing with a specific cultural situation here where traditionally violence and abuse against a woman has been seen almost as something natural, something to be expected. And therefore, an atmosphere, an environment, even a culture has grown up that victimizes the woman and provides an atmosphere in which the man can justify anything he wants to do with a woman, considering her his property. This law dealing with that reality and taking into account the fact that so much of this violence, and not all by any means, but so much of this violence and abuse of women takes place in small communities,
right,
where juries are very much affected by the dominant culture, the dominant prejudices, the dominant expectations, that the woman in just about all these cases was victimized,
yeah,
a second time.
Right.
Not only was she abused and beaten, but the man got off free. So with this new law, judges, specific judges dealing with violence, especially against women, were trained to deal with these cases, which touched, you know, cultural, religious, and they were trained specifically to deal with, and they would have the last word in these cases of abuse and violence against the woman. And what this these regulations are doing is that they're going back to a jury situation that is prejudicial against the woman.
How sad, because obviously the letter of the law, we might have been in better shape, but now the implementation is going another direction.
But I think, not to interrupt you, Wade, but
no,
I think it's real important to emphasize that in spite of these regulations and all the rest, when we look for hope and we look for mobilization and we look for organization and we look for the future of Nicaragua today,
we have to make the law work.
Well, we look to women.
That's
we
right.
look to
okay.
women, because it's the women, young and not so young, no, at local levels like Arenal, at regional levels like Messiah, and nationally around the country, it's the women organized who are putting pressure on society to bring more justice and equality.
And actually that happens in a lot of countries, not just Nicaragua, I think. It's our hope many, many places, Rob. Today on Wade's World, we're talking to Rob Curry, who's both a priest and an organizer, Jesuit priest, who's been in Nicaragua for, 27 years. I was doing the math almost quicker than my mouth could move. So he's been here long enough to know better and know Spanish well. Before we came down, one of the things we read was a very interesting New Yorker article earlier this year that talked about, I forget the title, but it was something like the President's Canal. But it talked about reviving that old plan before you and I and any of the listeners were born, to have a, you know, a lot of people probably have forgotten, but the history of the Panama Canal was also a huge proposal for a long time to build a canal through Nicaragua.
Sure.
And use where it thins down, but also the huge lake as part of the channel. And now, even though they're rebuilding the Panama Canal to bigger freight carriers and expanding it, it's a multi-billion dollar delayed project, there's talk of building another canal through Nicaragua. And one of the things we were talking about was, what in the world? People are thinking about that. Where is it at? What do people talk about here? Because that seems like a wild project, Chinese, but it also, your point about land comes in again, doesn't it?
Exactly. As you say, you know, the idea of building a canal in Nicaragua goes back to the time of the Spanish conquista. The Spaniards themselves thought of putting a canal through Nicaragua to connect the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans. And then, of course, later on, the British and the French and, of course, the United States. And the reason why the canal was not originally built through Nicaragua, but rather Panama, was because the president of Nicaragua at that time was doing everything so that the United States would not have the right to build that canal. And he was consulting with Japan to build the canal. So as the U.S. government has had a custom of doing with Nicaragua and Central America, the U.S. overthrew the Nicaraguan president, and just to spite the Nicaraguan people, they took land from Colombia, put it into, created Panama, and then put the canal through Panama.
We could have many shows about the role of the United States in Central America, which would be one of those, believe it or not. I mean,
that's right.
I don't
you
think
got it.
Most people in 2014 would believe the kind of footprints that the United States has left throughout Central America, even though Honduras recently was a good example.
2009.
Of how wrong we can be in calling the shots for anti-democratic governments.
But getting back to your question about the present plan of the canal, basically it's a plan by the current government without any consultation at the popular level. There was no referendum or no voting, nothing of that. It was just the president and a small circle of his advisors and business people said, let's go ahead. And they basically handed over half the territory of the country to a Chinese businessman.
And then gave him almost eminent domain, the right
eminent
to
domain.
Seize and
exactly.
Set the price and whatever.
Part of the arrangement with him, which here is called a concession, he can confiscate whatever land he wants. He can pay whatever price he wants to pay for that land, and he can hand over to whomever he wants the that land.
And so for any reason.
And for any reason. Yeah. So what a lot of us here, and this is thousands and thousands, apart from the political party of the government and big capital, like the Payless family and others, most people here feel that it's just an old-fashioned land grab where this land that is going to be confiscated will be handed over to other corporate interests to develop as they want to. In turn, they're already thinking of 4 or 5 tourist centers, a tax-free zone, and who knows how much more. But half the territory of the government of the country has been handed over to this Chinese businessman to do as he wants. And also, the route chosen passes right through for 105 kilometers the basic source of our drinking water in the country,
which is the lake, yeah?
The lake Nicaragua.
And they're going to deepen it by double the depth right now.
That's right, because the deepest point of this lake is 13 meters. For the ships to pass through that lake, they need a depth of between 27 and 30 meters, which means that they're going to have to basically create a canal within the canal that is double the depth of the canal, which it's hard to calculate the billions of tons of rock and sand that they're going to have to dredge. And this dredging
will
not end.
And on an ongoing basis.
Ongoing basis.
I mean, I know in Lake Pontchartrain, they still have to dredge today. I mean, the Mississippi River, don't tell me about the dredging. That's a big project for the Corps of Engineers every year. Besides hoping for women, though, you still believe it's on the local level we have our best chance. That's a